This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Hello, how are you this Monday afternoon? Kate Forrester with you. And guess what? You're stuck with me for another week here on the Country Hour right across Western Australia. Well, in the second half of the show today, a veteran of WA's honey industry says if the destructive varroa mite makes its way into WA, he's confident the state's honey industry will be able to adapt. Kim Fuster is a fourth generation beekeeper north of Perth, and he'll be along after the news and the news headlines, at 12:30. And he says, obviously, best case scenario is varroa is kept out. But after speaking to beekeepers from around the world, he's feeling confident he can live with the pest.
Young guy from Canada, and, 30,000 hives, him and his family up there. And that's why I said to him, you blokes have had varroa mite for 15, 20 years now. What do you do? He's just nonchalantly said, oh, Dad goes down to Home Depot and gets a big tub of grease, and then he goes around the ag store and gets some cattle tick and mixes it together and whacks it on. You might not be able to do that here, but no, it's not the end of the world for beekeeping. It's going to be very difficult for the horticulture industries, of course, because they're heavily dependent on bees.
Somehow I don't think we'll be seeing that concoction used in Australia anytime soon. But that chat coming up after the news headlines and weather at 12:30. 12:06 here on the Country Hour. And first up today, I'm keen to hear from grain farmers in the industry. Are you finding more of your grain is being downgraded this season? And if so, why do you think that is? Text number today is 0448 922 604. And I am keen to hear from you. Do you think it could have something to do with the new high-tech visual analysis equipment that's being used to scan grain this year at CBH sites? So that text number again is 0448 922 604. But Richard Hudson, you have some other grain news, and let me guess, have some records been broken?
Well, yeah, they have, but I'm going to keep you on tenterhooks for a moment. So, yeah, the CBH this morning, or the Cooperative Bulk Handling Group, has issued a media statement with its latest harvest figures, and it sounds like things have really cranked up a fair bit in the last week or so, because CBH has now received more than 15.2 million tonnes, and it broke its daily network receival record twice in 2 days, which is quite amazing. So last Wednesday, 678,000 tonnes came in, and then the following day on the Thursday, 680,000 tonnes were delivered. Then on the Friday, no, they went down a tiny bit, but it turned out to be their third best day on record, so very busy. Across the network, 18 sites achieved daily receival records, and CBH's Chief Operations Officer Mick Dorr says the last fortnight has been huge. So over 9 days, CBH received more than 500,000 tonnes a day, including 5 days above 600,000 tonnes. And he says they've passed the halfway mark in every zone. Esperance is, believe it or not, already starting to wind down as growers finish up. But activity is still ramping up in Kwinana South and Albany, and it's continuing onwards in Kwinana North and Geraldton. But Chris Tonkin runs the grain marketing company 10 Tigers, who have clients in all of Western Australia's grain growing areas. And he actually thinks the next few weeks could be even busier for workers at the CBH bins and for everyone in the industry.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, and last week was as well. We've finally got some great weather, and so people have just been able to barrel through the harvest, which has been excellent. And there's a lot of businesses that have got an extra header and stuff going this year as well than what they had in the last couple of years. So the volumes coming off when they get cranking are really, really big. And it was a pretty slow start overall. So this is actually really, really, we're pleased to get cranking right into it before we get too close to Christmas time.
Now, I hear there are a few little quality issues coming up, wheat in particular. Whereabouts are you hearing about those sorts of things?
Yeah, there is. And it is a little disappointing when you're coming off some amazingly record yields in different places. But a lot of it so far in the Albany zone. We've got little bits showing up in the Esperance zone and also in Kwinana zone as well, but particularly along the coast in Albany so far seems to be some fairly low falling number calculations so far with some fairly decent tonnages of wheat.
I'm hearing some farmers blaming the new visual analysis machines that are being used. They're wondering if there's more downgrades getting picked up because of the AI technology than there would have been just using humans' naked eye.
Yeah, well, this sounds like a political minefield, and you're probably spot on with that, actually, is that I've certainly heard the same thing, and look, it could well be the case. It may well be that, as one client told us, yeah, sometimes it's what you wish for that maybe you don't want, you know. Maybe in the past they still want to have the human intervention, but, you know, now we're going towards the AI and the totally fair and independent view of things. It is going to make life interesting, and the transition for the next year or two into different testing and stuff with the AI and the pitches, it's going to make it really intriguing just how this does change things, I guess. But it is the modern world, I guess, is what we're looking at. So we've basically got to accept it. But I'd certainly agree with some of those comments that people are saying, and there's certainly a fair bit of chatter around the traps.
There's probably going to be a record crop in Western Australia, which means there might be a fair amount of downgraded wheat that's going onto the market. And that's not great timing, because I hear Argentina's also having a record crop, aren't they?
Yes, yeah, they're coming in with a record crop, and by all accounts, they've had some quality issues and have been pushing grain into, you know, like the Philippines markets and other particular AWW1 feed sort of markets. And until recently, I think it was even up to like about a $20 a tonne cheaper price that they were pushing it into. I gather that's evened out a little bit more in the last few days, which is pretty handy, I guess, for us and being able to get some grain in there. But it certainly is an issue, and it's just another thing to manage at harvest, is to try and work out whether you can actually get your grain in good levels with the falling numbers, or whether we've just got to accept that it's going to be the lower quality in some areas, not in all areas. But, you know, the silver lining is that the yield is still there in most cases.
Overall, what do you think is going to be happening to some of the prices over the next few months, the grain prices?
Well, you would have to think in most cases when there's a lot of supply is that prices normally do head south. With the wheat, we've had very, very high basis levels still. I do think that we'll see potentially some issues in the noodle market, because we are seeing some lower proteins there well and truly in comparison to most years. So that's going to be an intriguing one. We have seen canola come back a little bit in this last week. A lot of it's been affected with the Aussie dollar, and particularly that gets to the US and the US interest rate differentials with Australia and what the outlook is for that in the next 3 to 6 months. And that does have a fair effect on a lot of markets. I'm pretty comfortable with like feed barley. You know, we're looking at levels currently that I think should be able to hold in relation to where the corn and other feed markets are. So that market looks quite good. The wheat market could still fall off a little bit more, and we'll probably see a lot more of the FAQ methodology coming in, where, you know, the spreads get probably closer to APW1. So that's going to be intriguing watching that. We're probably at pretty reasonable levels when we're looking at where the basis levels are for wheat at the moment. Mind you, it's never quite enough as to what everybody actually wants. But it is what it is, I guess, like that. So, yeah, that's probably most of our thoughts on different pricing at the moment. There's a lot of interesting factors going into it.
A lot of farmers are still going to have a pretty good year. And this year, as you have done previously, you're doing the work to trade some donated grain that's going to some charities, in particular Food Bank and the Fiona Wood Foundation. What's the story there?
Yes, we're definitely on the lookout to see if we can get some tons allocated from people when they're just coming to the end of their harvest. You know, with the very high yields that we're having, everyone trying to strike while the iron's hot, is that those particular organisations, and look, there's many very good charitable organisations around the place, but the Fiona Wood Foundation, they do need a lot of money to supply the services of what they actually can do. I think that's a really integral one, and I've seen that with a lot of people who have been there. And also Food Bank is just a organisation that does wonderful things right across the entire state. And so you're actually helping out quite a lot of people in relation to, you know, any little donations that can possibly come forward, whether it's even, you know, 1 tonne, 5 tonnes of feed barley or whatever it might be, it'd be very, very gratefully accepted.
I had my own interaction with a homeless person only about a week ago. He was not in a good way in a mental health capacity, so it's at the forefront of my mind. Anyway, how do you donate? It's not that hard these days, is it?
No, it's not that hard. In fact, once you can sit in front of the computer with LoadNet, you can actually hit the transfer button and pretty much put any tons you like to the CBH number for both of those organisations. And they both have a CBH delivery number. You could probably start typing in either Food Bank or Fiona Wood, and it should come up. If it doesn't, then we can certainly help with making sure that people can get those numbers anyway, because it can be a very quick process, a matter of minutes.
You do the work for that for free, aren't you? That's your sort of contribution, is that right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Look, there's a lot of organisations that we like to help around the place. And, look, any more good that we can spread around, I think, is wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. That was Chris Tonkin, who is the director of Ten Tigers Grain Marketing Company based in Geraldton, and he was speaking with Richard Hudson. And I am keen to get your thoughts on grain being downgraded this season, just what Chris and Richard were talking about earlier on in their chat. The text number is 0448 922 604. Chad has texted in and says, CBH will always try to downgrade receivables to the grower, either by not offering higher value segregations or varying optimisation requirements to restrict the grower from receiving the true value of their grain. Dropping lower grade loads on higher grade stacks is the norm. Our cooperative does not operate as one. Thanks for sharing your thoughts today, Chad. You can do so as well. 0448 922 604.
The WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Well, another major wind project could soon be taking shape in WA's Great Southern. The Cogenut Wind Farm Company has lodged a $750 million development application to build a 33-turbine wind farm about 20 kilometres from the town centre. The project is proposed to be built on broad acre farmland in Jingleup, with land access agreements already signed by property owners. If approved, the wind farm would generate 204 megawatts, and that's enough to power over 130,000 homes over its 30-year lifespan. The proponent has also signed a joint development agreement with state-owned energy producer Synergy. Now, public submissions are open until the 6th of January, and more information on this project can be found on the Shire of Cogenup's website. And while we're on the topic of wind farms, and with obviously summer just beginning and this heat really ramping up, a question you might be wondering is, who is liable if a fire starts on your farm and spreads to a neighbouring renewables facility? Australia's Energy Infrastructure Commissioner, Tony Marr, has been working to get more clarity on that question for landholders. He's been meeting with insurers and renewable energy companies to develop a policy, and says farmers need certainty where that responsibility lies.
We've been hearing a lot about concerns and queries about public liability insurance from landholders right across the country. So what we did is we got the insurance sector together. The energy sector just came up with a pathway forward to make sure that people's concerns around public liability insurance and any expectations of changes to that because of the neighbouring properties having renewable energy infrastructure can be addressed in a nationally consistent way, where the landholder isn't liable for, you know, public liability beyond what they've got in their existing farm pack or household insurance.
For example, it might be someone harvesting in a paddock next door to a solar or wind facility. A fire starts, fire sweeps through that facility, and that farmer being concerned that they'd be liable.
That's right. That's a good example, and you know, on the basis that it's accidental and not negligent or deliberate and things like that, then you know that the pathway we're going and the agreement and the commitment we've got from the energy sector companies and insurance sector is that particular scenario, the landholder is not liable for any damage caused. And their policies aren't impacted or premiums aren't impacted. It's just a recognition that the energy sector is responsible for that asset, not the landholder.
So what do you actually want to happen? Does this need to be in writing, legally binding, that neighbours will not be liable?
Yes, yeah, it does. That's what we're wanting to do. So we had an initial conversation. Been talking for a couple of months now with Clean Energy Council and Insurance Council of Australia and their members, but certainly what we're aiming to come up with is a clause in the contracts, you know, premiums or policies, commitments and, you know, watertight, legally binding commitments to give people confidence, landholders confidence that their existing public liability insurance doesn't have to be amended or revised adequate for their current purposes if they are close to renewable energy infrastructure. They don't have to worry about additional public liability insurance.
And the renewables companies you've spoken to, are they supportive of this?
Yeah, very. There's one company that's already doing it. There's another a lot of companies that are aware of it. But what we wanted to do is get a whole of industry approach with this. Again, we've had really good cooperation with the Clean Energy Council. They know it's an issue they need to address. The Insurance Council was likewise aware of it. Some details to work through, but the announcement this week is really that we've got that agreement to address this issue and make sure that there's no negative impact on landholders.
It's a long list, isn't it, the list of concerns of those who might end up being neighbours of some of these facilities?
Yeah, it is. I mean, and the obvious scenario that you outlined, it's predominantly where we started, but there are, in any sort of risk strategy, there's plenty of risks that you need to be aware of, but that immediate sort of fire risk and it flowing through a valley, which we know can go really quickly and damage lots of properties and assets and things, was one of the catalysts for this discussion. Look, it's going in the right direction. I'm really pleased that we've got agreement from insurance companies and energy companies to make sure that this isn't an issue going forward for landholders.
On the flip side to what we've been talking about, I know a lot of people have concerns about renewables facilities, battery sites or transmission lines starting fires. What's in place to protect those people and mitigate those concerns?
Yeah, look, a couple of things. That's certainly a concern that I hear about too as I travel around, and it absolutely needs to be addressed. I mean, the energy companies need to provide adequate information and confidence and demonstration that they are taking account of the fire risks. Related to the insurance aspects of, you know, if there's an incident from a battery or from a turbine, you know, starting a fire, then the absolute expectation is that the energy companies have, you know, the appropriate levels of insurance to cover all of that. And my understanding is that they do, but, you know, that should be part of the ongoing discussion with energy companies and the community to make sure that there's complete confidence in that regard.
The whole renewables topic is really dominating at the moment, whether you read the newspapers, listen to the radio, watch the TV or get on social media. Is it hard for the everyday punter to try and decipher what is and isn't fact?
Yes, it is. And that's hopefully one of the roles I can play as an independent commissioner, is to provide independent, you know, truthful advice. And there's many sources of information, but I do think we need to keep working in a really credible, transparent way around the information. There's lots of concerns, there's a lot happening, but I think people are really looking for, you know, truthful, transparent communication information to help them make decisions. So that's one of the roles that I hope I can help players to walk straight down the middle and you know, call out misinformation and provide information. So it's one of the tasks that I see myself assisting with.
That was Australian Energy Infrastructure Commissioner Tony Maher speaking with Angus Verley. And while we're on the topic of fires, when it comes to renewables and solar projects, over the weekend on the East Coast, one of Australia's largest solar farms was damaged by fire, with almost $2 billion worth of the solar farm burnt. The fire broke out on Saturday at Light Source's BP's 400-megawatt Wellington North solar farm, which is about 50 kilometres from Dubbo. And a spokesperson for the light source has said that the fire is fully under control and their teams are continuing to closely monitor the site. They're highly appreciative of the expertise and the swift response of the emergency services in managing the incident, and teams are also working to assess any impact with a focus on restoring the site to a safe operation. 24 past 12. And staying on the East Coast now, and with those devastating fires in New South Wales, it was extremely sad to hear over the weekend about the number of homes destroyed in the numerous bushfires that were burning across their state. In the Upper Hunter region, residents south of Merriwa, 270 kilometres northwest of Sydney, faced evacuations over the weekend as bushfires in their area raged. Now, that particular blaze has burnt more than 11,000 hectares. Cattle farmer Julie Keith came face to face with the fire as it moved through her property. She says she is so grateful for the fire crews who arrived in force.
Yes, it was very hectic. We knew the fire was coming and we knew the winds were going to be pressing it over our hill. We sort of have a mountain to look out over the Goulburn River. And it was smoky for days and days, and eventually we knew it was going to happen fairly soon. We were pretty organised. We had lots of water and lots of pressure and lots of hoses. But I don't think we would have been able to do much at all if the fireys hadn't turned up. They were amazing. They were really organised. The first truck came in and said, "We're here to look after you." And then after that, they just kept coming in, and it was absolutely necessary because the flames came over the hill, there were spot fires just went everywhere.
Gosh.
And a lot of the properties gone, but that's fine. It was the water bombing that they did continuously sort of held them at bay up the end of the valley. And then the dozers were here. They did just an amazing job. There was one fellow trying to cut a line in underneath the fire. It was just coming over the hill at him. And he did a fantastic job. So I can't stress enough just how good these guys were.
It's just incredible. We're so in debt to everything that they do, and it has been such a testing weekend right across the state.
Sure.
But you've been there, Julie, for a long time. Have you ever experienced a bushfire in that national park or so close to home for you?
Once we had the fire came over the hill, the same as it did. And it's extraordinary. The flames are so tall and it roars really. It's just an amazing experience. But that time it just rained. And it put it out before it came down the hill. So this is really a brand new experience for us. And hopefully we're going to have good memories of it, but we don't have to do it again.
Yes, let's hope that that's certainly not in the future for you. I know that there was a community meeting yesterday. I could only imagine how busy you've all been preparing, and so many properties and livestock out that way as well. Was that a good chance just to be in the same room with, I guess, your neighbours, if I can use that, and just supporting each other too?
Sure. I didn't head up there. My husband went up.
Mm-hmm.
But, yes, it was wonderful because the fire sort of went in a line. It jumped our house and then it went into the neighbour's property and then it's gone up onto the top of the hill going towards Barami Creek. So they're still fighting it and putting in lines there as we speak. So, it's a huge job.
Yeah. Did you have to evacuate stock at all, Julie? What's the scope of your property there?
We had to move cattle and we brought them over this side of the river and put them in a paddock that was well and truly eaten out. But luckily, there was a spot fire that went over our house again and it put that paddock on fire. The helicopter was there within seconds and the guys were all, because they were here, they just zoomed up into the paddock and put that out. But yeah, it's it put a lot of trees on fire around, not near the house, but they had a lot of work to do, the poor guys. But those guys and gals here, lots and lots of women firefighters, I've got to say, were fantastic. Yeah, I've been trying to say thank you to all of them that I spot, because they came through yesterday again to spot fires up in the valley. So it's continuing on.
cattle farmer Julie Keith from the Upper Hunter speaking with Amelia Berlusconi about the Milsons Gully bushfire burning between Sandy Hollow and Bylong, which is around 270 kilometres northwest of Sydney. That fire is still being controlled but has been downgraded back to an advice level today. And it was also devastating to hear about on the weekend those bushfires in Tasmania on their east coast. The Tasmania Fire Service has confirmed that a bushfire at Dolphin Sands, which is 140 kilometres northeast of Hobart, has destroyed, I should say, 19 homes, with another 40 properties damaged. And it is interesting because I know in that area it is one road in, one road out, so that really heightens that risk when people are trying to evacuate. And it's an issue we deal with a lot here in Western Australia too. So thoughts are with those who have been affected from those bushfires over the weekend. It is 12:30 here on the Country Hour, and Jonathan Bill, you are in the studio with the headlines.
I am indeed. Thanks, Kate. The WA coroner has recommended the urgent closure of the Unit 18 juvenile detention facility at Casuarina Adult Prison. Philip Urquhart has handed down the findings of his inquiry into the death of 16-year-old Cleveland Dodd, who self-harmed in Unit 18 2 years ago. Mr. Urquhart says the Department of Justice has made significant improvements since Cleveland Dodd's death, but Unit 18 remains unfit for purpose. Federal Nationals MP Michael McCormack says it's disappointing Barnaby Joyce has chosen to join One Nation. In a statement, the One Nation leader, Pauline Hanson, says Mr. Joyce will continue to represent his New England electorate until the next election. She says he'll then stand as a candidate for her party on the New South Wales Senate ticket. And the federal government has announced it will not extend its annual $300 energy bill rebate beyond December. Cabinet has met today to sign off on the decision ahead of next week's mid-year budget update. The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, says it's a difficult decision, but the budget is under pressure. More news, Kate, at 1 o'clock.
Thanks, Jonathan.
You're listening to the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Well, it is 29 away from 1 o'clock. We're heading up to the weather with the Bureau just to check in on what's happening around the state this afternoon and the next couple of days. Between now and 1 o'clock, you are going to be heading over to Mushay just to get those results of the cattle yarding today and the total number. But before we get there, let's now chat to Luke Huntington, who is with the Bureau. Luke, we've heard about those really high temperatures in the north of the state. Are they set to hang around for this afternoon and the next couple of days?
Yeah, that's right, Kate. So, it's pretty much stagnant weather conditions up there in the Kimberley and Pilbara at the moment. So we are seeing those maximum temperatures reaching the mid-40s during the day through parts of the inland Pilbara and southwest Kimberley. And what's contributing to the heat wave is the overnight temperatures as well in the high 20s and even near 30 overnight. So that's going to It persists for the next 3 days. It's probably not till Thursday where we start seeing the temperatures starting to gradually drop. So just a few more days of this severe to extreme heat up there. But we're also seeing hot conditions also extending into the Gascoyne region with pretty much the whole district through the inland parts reaching above 40 as well. In terms of thunderstorm activity today over the northern half, we're looking at thunderstorms and showers over the Kimberley. Mainly this afternoon and into the evening. There are a couple of storms just in the far north at the moment, but they're pretty typical thunderstorms expected for this time of year, so not expecting any warnings with those storms. And then heading into tomorrow for the northern half, a continuation of showers and thunderstorms over the Kimberley, but this time extending into the northern interior and into the very far northeastern parts of the Pilbara. Again, just typical storms for this time of year. As we head into Wednesday, the storms continuing right throughout the Kimberley north interior and parts of the central and eastern Pilbara. So the thunderstorms just extending a little bit further west into the Pilbara, probably reaching as far west as Karratha, but probably not getting to the coast, remaining just inland from that region. And on Thursday, a very similar area for the thunderstorm activity. So right throughout the Kimberley, the north interior, criteria, the central and eastern Pilbara, and basically an identical area for the Friday period. So a very large area of thunderstorms right throughout the Kimberley interior and into the central and eastern Pilbara.
And what about now if we move down to the Southwest Land Division, what's happening?
Yeah, there's not much happening. There was a weak cold front that just brushed the south coast this morning, so that delivered a couple of millimetres to near south coastal areas. But the temperatures today are pretty mild along that south coast due to that front, so only the low 20s. So the Albany Esperance region, the hottest temperatures for the Southwest Land Division today are over the Wheatbelt area and into the inland central west, temperatures reaching in the mid to high 30s. As we head into tomorrow, the thunderstorm activity does start to increase in through the eastern parts of the Southwest Land Division. Basically eastern Wheatbelt, eastern Great Southern and down into the Esperance area. We could see some thunderstorms tomorrow. So that could be from the early morning period. Most of the afternoon thunderstorms, though, should have cleared the Wheatbelt area, and it should be confined just to east of Esperance. So we're not expecting too much thunderstorm activity. It should be fairly isolated and not much rainfall either with any thunderstorms that do form. And then heading into Wednesday, we do see a contraction of thunderstorms. So we're only forecasting storms in the Southwest Land Division, just in the very far eastern parts of the southeast coastal district, which is sort of around the Israelite Bay area. So just a small area. And there's also just a chance of a light shower just about the coast east of Albany. In terms of temperatures on Wednesday, we do see temperatures still pretty high throughout the inland central west into the wheat belt in the mid to high 30s. Great Southern increases into the low 30s. And then heading into Thursday, we do see thunderstorms increase again over southern parts of the Southwest Land Division. So we're talking about through the southern wheat belt into the Great Southern area and through the Esperance region. Those thunderstorms should be mainly in the afternoon period, and they're going to be fairly dry as well, so little to no rainfall associated with them. So dry lightning is a possibility with those storms Thursday afternoon. And then temperatures do increase quite a bit through the Wheatbelt area. So we're looking at pretty much every place in the Wheatbelt getting to 40 or 41 degrees. And through the inland central west, we could see temperatures in the high 30s to near 40 degrees. Through the Great Southern area, especially through the northern parts, it could be nudging 40 degrees as well, but staying mild along the coastline. Friday, we do see an increase in thunderstorms as well. So pretty much an area away from the west coast is forecasting showers and thunderstorms. So that includes the Esperance region into most of the wheat belt, the eastern Great Southern area. And those thunderstorms on Friday, there could be a little bit of rainfall in the southern part of that thunderstorm area. So around the Esperance area, could maybe get a few millimetres. But otherwise, the thunderstorms should be fairly dry with little to no rainfall at this stage. And the temperatures for Friday do drop back a bit. The temperatures back into the high 20s through the Great Southern, but still remaining into the mid to high 30s through the northern wheat belt and the inland central west.
Thanks so much, Luke, for going through that for me.
Thanks.
All right, Richard Hudson, there was a little bit of rain around over the weekend.
Yeah, not heaps though. So from 9 o'clock in the morning on Friday through to 9 a.m. today, in the Kimberley, probably as you'd imagine, had the most. Doongan had 9, Drysdale River Station 12, Halls Creek 8, Columbaroo 7, Kununurra had between 7 and 15 across a couple of locations. And then in the Southwest Land Division, there was some dust settling rain, I think you could call it. In the Central West, Moascar had 2. In the Southwest, Beetle Up and Carlotta 3, Pemberton 4, and then in the southern coastal region, Albany 5, Bremer Bay and Denmark had 3 mils, Chain Beach 6, and Nalyalup had 4, so not heaps. Just a quick one. We got a text from someone saying, can we nominate a charity for overloaded tonnages? So this is referring to the chat I had with Chris Tonkin. And I just gave him a call. And what we're referring to here is grain trucks that have legal limits. And if you go over that legal limit, then the extra grain gets forfeited. And then at the end of the season, CBH can determine which charities they donate that forfeited grain to. He's unsure exactly how CBH decides which main charities they donate that forfeited grain to, but maybe it's a suggestion to put through your local CBH rep. You know, can you actually nominate a charity of your choice if your grain gets forfeited? Mm. It might get a bit fiddly.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, there's so many to choose from. Thank you for going through that, Richard. It is 21 away from 1 o'clock on the Country Hour. And a veteran WA beekeeper thinks the industry will be able to adapt if the destructive varroa mite reaches Western Australia. The parasite, which weakens and kills honeybees, has recently been detected in hives just across the border in South Australia. Kim Fuster is a fourth-generation beekeeper north of Perth, and he says after speaking with apiarists around the world, he's confident WA can learn to live with the pest if it does eventually cross into our state.
The industry and the government has put in a preparedness plan, so West Australian industry has got together with some very high-tech companies and they've developed a bait station, which is just a sugar solution. And in the bait station, there's cameras which photographs the bees which come and eat the sugar. And if it detects a varroa mite, this software will immediately alert the industry. The big takeaway from the New South Wales, where they first found it, was that they didn't detect it early enough. They predict that when they did find it, it had been there at least 18 months.
And is that surveillance system giving you enough of a sense of reassurance? Do you feel like that will provide the early detection that's needed?
Yeah, I think so, because it's in the main regions where there's going to be products coming in. The likelihood of it coming in on the bonnet of a road train is pretty high, because varroa mite can live 5 or 6 days without on a host of the bee. Their biggest fear is a road train or a caravan and go through a swarm of bees in Victoria or New South Wales.
So is it inevitable? Is that what you're saying?
Well, not really. I've got to give a huge amount of credit to the Department of Agriculture and Quarantine, because our border was closed in 1977 to stop European fowl brood coming in, and it hasn't come in. So nearly 50 years, they've kept it out. With the help of all the people that come across the border and everybody concerned, with that in mind, I'm very optimistic that our department has got the tools to make sure that whatever comes across is heavily scrutinised. Because it's a living organism, it's a living critter, a lot of chances that it'll come in.
So how do you prepare yourself for that when you think about the amount of movement of bees that you as an individual do, let alone the industry in WA? Can you prepare for it or make a contingency plan in case varroa is found here?
Varroa mite's been in the bee industry for as long as bees have, so millions of years. Varroa mite and honeybees have coexisted, but it was only with the Asian honeybee, Apis arana, that was its host for thousands, hundreds of thousands of years. But with the widespread use of European honeybees throughout all of Asia now, and it spread through there, the European honeybee will or has found a mechanism to live with the varroa mite the same as Apis arana. So all they've got to do is develop or breed a bee or find the bee that uses the same triggers, the same cleaning ability to look after a varroa mite. Our feral population of bees, which we would have one of the biggest populations of feral bees in the world because of our disease-free status, they're very resistant to all the diseases that we've got here already. And I think our European honeybees will survive. There's going to be some pain in the beginning, but if you just get over that pain and try and manage it, look, I'm confident that, like in other places of the world, they have developed varroa-resistant bees, or ones that don't have very much of a loading. There's lots of ways you can control it. You know, with chemicals, there's only one. You've got organic ways where you just let the queen lay in drone combs, and then the varroa mite likes drones, so you just pull them out every couple of weeks, freeze them, so you take a big load out. In the USA and Canada, they put all their bees, lock them all up in big sheds over winter. There's no brood for 4 months, 3 months, so the varroa mite, the count's very low.
So you don't sound really stressed about it, Kim. You reckon it's going to be okay?
Well, look, it's best if it doesn't come here, but I've had beekeepers from all over the world. Young guy from Canada, and 30,000 hives, him and his family up there. And that's why I said to him, you blokes have had varroa mite for 15, 20 years now, what do you do? And he's just notchedly said, oh, Dad goes down to Home Depot and gets a big tub of grease, and then he goes around the ag store and gets some cattle tick and mixes it together and whacks it on. So it's pretty, that was it. But, you might not be able to do that here. But no, it's not the end of the world for beekeeping. It's going to be very difficult for the horticulture industries, of course, because they're heavily dependent on bees. And now we've found the almond big orchards in the eastern states. They're looking for bees from WA because they can't source enough from the eastern states. Select Harvest and the Duxton Group, I think they're looking for 4,000 hives to go across, and they're paying, quite good money for them.
And how will that play out, that pollination industry in WA, if varroa is found here? What will that then look like? Because that's an arm of your business as well.
It just means that there'll be an added cost of treating the hives every year. So it'd be maybe $30 to $40 a year to treat the hives. Just like drenching sheep or cattle, it's the same. We just have to treat them like any other livestock.
Beekeeper Kim Fuster speaking to Joe Prendergast. On ABC Radio WA, this is the WA Country Hour. Well, it is 12:45, and for the first time in 12 years, the September quarter was positive for raising money in mineral exploration. And nearly $3.5 billion flowed into the sector in those 3 months alone. Sharif Andraus represents business advisory firm BDO. He says most of that money has gone into gold exploration, but increasingly it has also gone into critical minerals.
After the June quarter, we were expecting a downturn probably in the strength of a lot of the metrics for capital raising and expenditure and everything for exploration companies, but actually it was the opposite. And we saw for the first time in a long time, we saw an increase actually in the September quarter on the decrease. We've actually seen the amount of money that's been raised by explorers on the ASX hit nearly $3.5 billion, which is, I think, the second highest since we've been doing it. A very healthy sign.
Yeah. So what do you think has been behind that?
Yeah, well, I think there's a few things. Well, the first thing, obviously, there has to be money around that needs a home, needs to be invested, and there's certainly money around in both in the superannuation sector, but also overseas money looking for a home. So money's available, which is number one. There's probably three factors that have drawn money into the sector. One is perhaps the most obvious one, which is the gold price is strong, and the gold price has been strong for a little while, and I think that most people believe the gold price will stay strong for some time to come. Another one which is key is around the interest in critical minerals and rare earths, etc. There's certainly a feeling that, or perhaps a growing recognition that the West has fallen behind in terms of the supply of the critical minerals that are required for everyday life. And so there's some investment coming into that area now, will be a bit belated, but certainly with the things that US have been doing, etc., there's more money coming into various critical minerals. The last one, which is perhaps a smaller one, is we've started to see a demand for energy that's come in general for net zero, but also uranium in terms of nuclear is a third strand of energy security have been a cause for this as well. So quite a few different reasons.
Sharif Andraus is BDO's Global Natural Resources and Energy Leader, and he was speaking to Tara DeLandgraf. 12:01. And I think that money that is coming through into the mining exploration sector is getting spent pretty quickly, and it's mostly in gold. The latest Australian Bureau of Statistics figures show there was a 45% rise in gold exploration over that three-month period. Neil van Drunen represents the Association of Mining and Exploration Companies and says that increase is a positive sign for WA's finances.
WA is like a monster when it comes to mining. We are the gorilla in the cage. Around 60% roughly of exploration occurs in Western Australia, and at the moment a lot of that is gold, which is great because the gold price is so high at the moment, so it makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And given that the gold price has been so high for about 2 years now, Neil, I mean, does it feel like it took a little bit of time to get to this point that money is going back into exploration?
Yeah, there's been a little bit of a lag, I think. There's no real like rhyme or reason sometimes to this, but it's really great to see that the mineral exploration end of the market is beginning to enjoy increased interest from investors, and also that is pouring through into drill holes on the ground, which is the key way, like that is the way to find the next mines, the mines of the future.
And talking of those drill holes, has it been sort of greenfields exploration, brownfields? Where is it at?
So there's been growth in greenfields comparatively, but a drop in brownfields. So the majority of the exploration nationally is always going towards brownfields, but greenfields is strong, so that's good.
Yeah, it is. And as you say, I suppose given the economics, people are saying, well, the price is so high, let's go somewhere where people haven't looked before. Are they getting good value for money doing that?
Part of the challenge that we face is that there are rising costs in Australia. We all enjoy a high standard of living, and that just makes it slightly more expensive than other places. But we do have great certainty of tenure. We've got great, as soon as you go and find something, you don't have to worry about anyone taking it off you, and that should never be sneezed at.
So given there has been this significant rise over the last 12 months, gold prices, they've sort of stabilised a bit now. They're off their peak, but they're relatively steady. Do you expect that there will be a continued push for gold exploration?
I wish I knew. If I knew that, I probably wouldn't be doing the job I'm doing, and I'd be sunning myself right now somewhere else. But given that it's up, it usually stays up for a while. So I would have suggested that we're beginning to see that a cycle again emerging of investors putting money into exploration. And as soon as people start drilling and extending drill holes, we usually then see discoveries being made, and hopefully they will find some future mines. So I'm optimistic.
Thank you for that. That was on Neil Van Drunen is with AMEC, the Association of Mining and Exploration Companies, and he was speaking with Tara de Langraft. Well, you might have heard the sad news last week that country music legend, author and a former administrator of the Northern Territory, Ted Egan, has died aged 93. Ted lived an extraordinary life, which included golden guitar wins in Tamworth and being an inaugural life member of the Australian Stockman's Hall of Fame. He produced 30 albums during his career, including classic hits such as Drinkers of the Territory, The Drover's Boy and She's On Again in Darwin. Musician Matt Scullion was a good friend of Ted's and last year released a tribute song to Ted called Beer Box Man. He spoke to Matt Brand soon after the news of Ted's death.
Absolutely heartbroken. Absolutely heartbroken. It's funny, I was just writing, I'm just halfway through trying to write a post to put up on my social media and just trying to find the right words to say. I really don't know if there is any words. I will say, but that I'm just so glad that I went out of my way to go to Alice Springs last year, and so I've written a song called Beer Box Man about Ted. And my wife and I went up there, and we went up there and spent three beautiful days with Ted, and sat around his table, dinner table, and swapped stories and songs. And we went out and shot the video. And he even took us for a drive in his old Land Cruiser, at 92 years old. But, I'm just really glad that I got to spend that little bit of time with him. I spoke with him a couple of weeks ago because I knew that he was ill, and just had a really quick chat. And I had a feeling then that it was going to be my last time I spoke to him. But Ted had a wonderful life. He really did. And I think if Ted was, if Ted could talk now, he would be saying, "Don't feel sad for me." He really did squeeze every bit of juice out of life, and I'm pretty sure that he didn't die with any regrets.
An extraordinary life, so many chapters to it.
And look, what a wonderful legacy the man has. He his music is such a small part of it, you know. And I got to know him through his music and then found out all these amazing other things about him, all the other the people he helped and the legacy he left. And, you know, he was so passionate about the Indigenous people of this country, you know, and so much that he did for them and to bring awareness to different issues and the wonderful books that he wrote for kids to teach people about Australia and about this, you know, like our history and, yeah, just, and, you know, school teacher, you know, so many different things. A park ranger up in Arnhem Land. He was a champion footballer too, you know.
And he was a driving force behind St Mary's.
Exactly. And a lot of people don't know that, you know. He was the first one that ever brought Tiwi Islanders over to play in the competition in Darwin. He was the first one to do that with a few other people, but he was one of the first to do that. There's so many layers to his life.
We're about to play your song, The Beer Box Man, and it starts with that very familiar tapping sound. It's just a famous sound connected to Ted, isn't it, that beer box?
It is, and Ted used to call it his foster phone.
Ted Egan, he's a pioneer, made a drum from an empty carton of beer, plays it in a style all of his own, calls it the foster phone. Singing up Australia with his songs, tapping out a rhythm on an empty beer box drum. He's got the crowd in the palm of his hand. Everybody loves the beer box man. Of the outback, tales from long ago, songs about the characters we've come to love and know. From the drover's boy with its hard to swallow truth, to the toe-tapping man from Humpty Doo. Singing up Australia with his songs, tapping out a rhythm on an empty beer box drum. He's got the crowd in the palm of his hand. Everybody loves the beer box man. Beer box man. Beer box man.
I've lived a long and blessed life, travelled this great wide land, in all its colours, met people of renown, tried my hand at lots of things, but I'm mainly an observer. I'm pleased my songs have been so well received.
Ted Egan, he's an inspiration, a voice of compassion for the First Nations. With 30 albums to his credit, we can crown him the unofficial king of Alice Springs. Singing up Australia with his songs, tapping out a rhythm on an empty beer box drum. He's got the crowd in the palm of his hand. Everybody loves the beer box man. Yarn spinning, folks singing, larrikin. Everybody loves the beer box man. Everybody loves the beer box man.
Wow, the unofficial king of Alice Springs. That was The Beer Box Man by Matt Scullion, a song all about country music legend Ted Egan, who passed away aged 93.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today as the recovery efforts continue in the New South Wales and Tasmanian fire zones. One firefighter has been killed by a falling tree. Pressure mounts on Sport and Communications Minister Annika Wells over her family's travel claims, which, while they don't flout the rules, critics argue they don't pass the pub test. And one of Australia's largest multi-level marketing schemes targets tradies, amongst others, but critics argue its business model relies on predatory recruitment tactics. Those stories and more. Join me for The World Today.
Now, there was a cattle sale at Mouchet Sale Yards this morning, but we've had a few issues, Alan, just getting Terry Birkin to run us through what happened at the sale. There is a sheep sale tomorrow, so hopefully we can get hold of Terry and find out what prices were like at both of the sales, so a double whammy. Coming up to the news at 1 o'clock, and earlier in the show I mentioned how the Cogenut Wind Farm Company has lodged an application to build a 33-turbine wind farm near the town. On the text line, Colin says, "Jingle up, farmers. Please do not spoil some of the most attractive and productive country in our state. See what happens when the subsidies run out, crippling our business and our company." Thank you for your thoughts. It's 1 o'clock. It's news time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.